Science fiction is everywhere in today's pop culture. Much of that can be traced back to the 30s and 40s in a pulp magazine called Astounding. Plus, do you have summer road trip plans yet? Because there are great food destinations that aren't too far from Illinois. If you have a favorite, text us at 217-394-5765. And a Naperville native has racked up nearly $1.7 million in Jeopardy. We'll talk to another Illinois resident about what it's really like to go up against him and be a contestant.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, have you been watching James Holzhauer's winning streak on Jeopardy? We'll talk about what it's like to be on the show, talk to another Illinois resident who's gone up against him, and what makes that program so special. Plus, we want to hear from you about your road trip plans, but we don't want to know where you're going. We want to know about what you're going to eat, your favorite food destinations to road trip to. Send us a text at 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. But first, science fiction is everywhere this year, it seems. Not just in the form of our favorite movies, books, or TV shows, but even in the actual technology we use in our daily lives. But the story of sci-fi goes back decades. Long before films like Star Wars or 2001: A Space Odyssey, the 1930s and 40s are known as the golden age of science fiction. This era and the people in it is the subject of Chicago writer Alec Nevila Lee's latest book. It's called Astounding: John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. And what tied all these men together is the science fiction magazine called Astounding, which in many ways helped create the genre. I spoke with Alec last winter from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and I started by asking him how Astounding paved the way for the sci-fi that so many of us enjoy in today's mainstream culture.
In some ways, I wrote this book out of my own curiosity about how modern science fiction emerged. And as you said, you know, it's such a big part of mainstream culture these days that it's very easy for us to take it for granted. But if you look at how it actually evolved, you know, you see that it kind of comes into being at this very specific point in the late 30s and early 40s in the pages of pulp magazines. This was a self-contained subculture that had very passionate fans, but it was not something that a lot of readers were aware of. And it was small enough that a small number of writers and editors could have a really outsized influence. So one of my goals was to kind of look at their lives and their careers and kind of see how their opinions and their interests and, you know, sort of the very messy aspects of their biographies affected what we know as science fiction today.
Alec, I think it's such an interesting thing. I really enjoy reading science fiction, and I probably watch a lot more science fiction than I read. But I had never heard of these pulp magazines. But there are a lot of people, and I'm thinking about how these pulp magazines continue to inspire real-life innovators. Is there sort of like a underground cult following of these magazines still to this day?
Absolutely, for the magazines, and even more so for the authors they publish for the first time. You know, people like Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, you know, if you look at someone like Elon Musk, who in some ways embodies, you know, some of the best and the worst aspects of that kind of culture. He talks about reading Asimov growing up. He put a digital copy of Asimov's Foundation trilogy into space earlier this year on one of his Falcon Heavy rockets. And again, it's very symbolic because a lot of people that went on to have great careers in the sciences and in STEM fields, they were inspired to become scientists and engineers by the science fiction they read growing up. This is especially true of older readers. I found that this book tends to appeal to, at least, you know, at this stage, to readers of a certain age. And I will say it does make a great holiday gift for your parents if, you know, they grew up reading science fiction. So I'll just throw that out there. But, you know, it also affects the media and the stories that science fiction fans of all backgrounds are reading. You know, this is kind of like where the rules were set down. And you can really see the influence of, you know, this one magazine, Astounding, in almost every kind of science fiction that you see today.
And like Elon Musk, these men have very complicated histories. There's a lot to be told about them, both positive and negative. And I wanted to ask you first just about the magazine itself. John W. Campbell Jr. becomes known as its most famous editor. How did these pulp magazines first get established?
So the first science fiction pulp magazine was actually called Amazing Stories, and it was founded by an immigrant named Hugo Gernsback from Luxembourg in the late 20s. And, those first magazines, they weren't that great. You know, the stories at least were kind of forgettable, at least by today's standards, and very few of those works have survived, as far as like still attracting new readers. But they, definitely inspired a passionate fan base, especially among younger writers or younger fans. And about 10 years later, those fans who kind of grew up with the pulps are old enough to start writing stories for themselves. And that's kind of the second wave of science fiction, where you don't just have professional pulp writers, who might have made their mark in like other genres like Westerns or adventure fiction or nautical fiction. You have people who have been reading this stuff since they were 12 years old. And obviously, they're going to care about the genre and they're going to care about science fiction on a deeper level. And so Campbell, who was born in 1910 and became the editor of Astounding in 1937, was basically in the right place at the right time to take advantage of that generation of writers. And, it was a very small market at that point. You know, there were only a handful of really established magazines in the field. And Astounding, when Campbell took over, was already the most prestigious, well-regarded magazine in the field. And so if you were an ambitious writer, if you cared about science fiction, Campbell was really your only market. So he was able to exert a disproportionate amount of influence on science fiction and kind of what it became. And so Campbell had certain ideas about what science fiction should be and what were the appropriate or, the most promising avenues of exploration for science fiction. And so his tastes and his prejudices really shaped the genre for decades to come.
And so I think it's kind of crazy to read about Isaac Asimov, who started, as you mentioned, as one of these fans, and how many of his early works were rejected by Campbell. Is it something like 8 or 9 times before he had a submission that was accepted by Campbell?
Yes. So Asimov is a really interesting case because he was a fan first. This is a young man who was born in 1920 in Russia, and he's an immigrant. He comes over, and when he's very young, when he's 12 years old, he starts to read these magazines. And, all he wants to do is write science fiction. And so, when he's about 18 years old, he writes his first story and sends that to Campbell, who rejects it. But the great thing is that these two start to meet on a monthly basis. Asimov lives nearby. And so he takes the train into Manhattan once a month, and Campbell kind of sees him as a protege. And, he does break in eventually. He's very young. He's 19 years old when he publishes his first story in Astounding. And Campbell sees him as this almost like an experimental subject where, he's clearly talented, clearly eager, clearly full of potential, and very willing to take instruction, very willing to use Campbell's ideas. And so for the next few years, you have this, really interesting dynamic where Campbell will come up with an idea for a story, for example, the 3 laws of robotics, which are, a very famous contribution of science fiction to mainstream and to scientific culture. Things like those laws, they came from Campbell. Campbell had lots of ideas, and, he was a great writer in his own right, but he was even more eager to be an editor because it meant that he had hundreds of writers working for him to realize his ideas in their stories. And so someone like Asimov, who's, more than happy to use those ideas, becomes the greatest possible instrument for Campbell to express those notions.
When you say he had a specific philosophy, I wonder how you think that was, how he thought science fiction should be written.
Well, so Campbell is a very interesting figure because, on the one hand, he is associated with kind of the progression of science fiction in terms of the quality of the writing, the characters, and in particular of the science. So, Campbell was, he went to MIT and Duke University, where he studied physics, so he had the background to make sure the stories were scientifically accurate. And so, for the first time, he was very, anxious to have stories where the science actually made sense. So that was part of it. But the other really interesting thing about Campbell is that he's one of the first editors to say basically that science fiction isn't just about technology or about space travel. It's about cultural change. Campbell is really interested in psychology and sociology, and he thinks that these are fields that are not quite exact sciences yet, but they could be. And so there's a huge thread in the science fiction of this period where psychology and sociology are kind of raised to the level of engineering. And so, you know, you see this in Asimov's Foundation series, which is a very famous example of a story where the lead character basically turns history into an exact science. You can predict the future for, you know, up to hundreds of years in the future, you know, based on, you know, principles that you extract from your observations of human behavior. And this is a theme that Campbell thought was fascinating. In some ways, the idea that science fiction is about cultural change, about different scenarios, about what could happen, you know, to our society in the future, you know, that's central to what science fiction became in the mainstream. I think people respond to that, you know, on a much deeper level than they do to the technological side. And Campbell was kind of the first person to say, you know, we're not just, you know, here to entertain readers. We're here to generate scenarios for what could happen to, you know, our culture. And I think that's a huge part of what science fiction became.
Alec, I think one of the more fascinating parts of this book is to think about how nerd culture is kind of also pretty mainstream in the U.S. these days. And I'm thinking about how many people go to things like Comic-Con. What was it like in the beginning for science fiction fans and events that and gatherings they had, like Worldcon, which really I imagine you think are the precursors to what these huge mass gatherings that we see today?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question because on the one hand, so fan culture in the period that we're talking about here, which is, you know, the late 30s, early 40s, you know, it's a much smaller world than it was today. It's a subculture. And you know, it consists of, you know, a handful of fans in cities like New York or Los Angeles who can actually get together and start clubs and have meetings. But, you know, in some ways, those dynamics, they have not changed. All right. One thing that I was really struck by when I was doing my research for this book is that you look at, you know,
they were even like trolls in the 30s.
Exactly. You know, the trolling, the flame wars, you know, the brigading. It's the exact same thing that you see today on Twitter or on Reddit, except that it unfolds in letters columns, that it unfolds in mimeograph fanzines. So these controversies, they kind of blow up and they take months to play out as opposed to a few hours online. But the behaviors and kind of the language and, you know, the way that you can have a community of outsiders that also starts to exclude others, you know, these things are there from almost day one. And so I actually found that I understood some of the more recent kind of manifestations of fan culture on a much deeper level after having thought about how they emerged in the 30s.
And to that point about people being excluded, this is largely the story of four white men. How do you think women and others played a role in this early culture?
Yeah, I mean, one of the high points for me of writing this book was to tell the stories of people like Donya Campbell, Campbell's first wife, who played a huge role in his career, you know, in some ways was his unofficial assistant editor. And
at what point they suggest during World War II she can take over the magazine?
This is a great story. Yeah. So what happens is that, and the other I should mention first that the other amazing figure in the story is Leslyn Heinlein, who was Heinlein's wife at the time, and again was his collaborator. I mean, I should also really mention that Heinlein was probably Campbell's best writer, certainly the one that he thought of most highly, you know, and probably had the greatest influence on science fiction as it evolved. He and Leslyn worked very closely on these stories, and they would pitch ideas back and forth and come up with the plots together. So she was a big part of his career. And you see this very clearly after Pearl Harbor, because Heinlein is an arch patriot. He's very eager to sign up. And Campbell is more reluctant. You know, he has two magazines he's running, and he's concerned that without him, they'll just kind of die out. And Heinlein has this amazing letter where he says, well, I think that Donya and Leslyn could do as good a job or better than you of running the magazine. And that to me just you know, it never actually went anywhere, but you know, it just speaks volumes about the influence and the importance they had to their husbands' careers. But it is true that the slate of writers and fans during this period was not very diverse. You know, they were mostly white males. And, you know, I'm very aware of this fact. And, you know, it's a big part of the book, the question of diversity, because in some ways, Campbell, he bears part of the blame for limiting the range of voices that science fiction had for a long time, because he was, you know, he expressed some very racist opinions in the magazine. He did not see diversity as a priority. And it was a real loss, because this is an editor who thinks that science fiction is really about cultural change. And if you want to have a conversation about cultural change, it makes a lot of sense to try to bring in voices who have been affected by cultural change for real in ways that, you know, might not be expressed by, you know, the fairly homogenous group of writers that Campbell was using. So I think it's a big loss. And I think, you know, that's a huge part of the story.
There's a line that I think you write at the end of the book that we're now living in a science fictional world. And I can't help think about a conversation I had earlier this year about Arthur C. Clarke and the 50th anniversary of 2001 A Space Odyssey being this year in 2018, which is kind of crazy to think. So Arthur C. Clarke is someone who follows the legacy. He's part of the legacy after these guys that we've been talking about. But I wonder how you think science fiction and these principles live on when we are seeing advances in real life that were predicted in fiction decades ago?
It's a very interesting question because I think there is sort of a good side and a bad side. Campbell's legacy as a writer or as an editor is very visible here. He certainly worked with Clarke. But, you know, the notion that all problems can be solved through technology or that all problems can be seen as subsets of engineering is one that I think, Campbell and his writers were largely responsible for. You know, and on the one hand, you see this in kind of the people they encouraged to enter careers in the sciences, which is a big part of their legacy and, you know, which is obviously great. But at the same time, you know, there are certain problems that probably can't be solved entirely through technology. One example is climate change. And I think about this a lot because I think there's a sense that if we can figure out some kind of geoengineering solution, you know, or we can get someone like Elon Musk or a billionaire to kind of solve these problems for us, you know, that we don't have to deal with like the deeper social issues that they uncover. And I think that's a big liability. I think it actually can turn into an excuse to not seek out other kinds of change. And I think it's pretty clear that there are aspects of human life that can't be reduced to engineering. You know, one thing that we haven't really talked about so far is L. Ron Hubbard, who was, you know, one of Campbell's most popular
writers. I know that's
a
big part of the book that we didn't have a chance to get to. But even how the whole idea of Dianetics is introduced in the pages of this magazine.
Yeah, I mean, the very short version is that, you know, Hubbard's ideas were about reducing psychology to a kind of engineering. Campbell loved that idea. You know, it was one that he returned to repeatedly. And in Hubbard's case, you know, the ultimate result was Scientology. So it kind of goes both ways. You can have a genre that affects the future in very positive ways, you know, by encouraging people to enter the sciences, but it also in some ways tends to pass over the limitations of that kind of worldview. And I try to bring up both sides in this book.
Alec Nevila Lee's latest book is called Astounding: John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert A. Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. Alec, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. This was great.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to deciding where to go on a road trip, maybe you're looking for scenery or historic sites. But if you're like me, it is also about where you will eat. And lucky for us, there are lots of fabulous food spots within a few hours' drive from Illinois. Chicago Magazine recently captured some of its favorite dining and driving destinations in its May issue. Carrie Shudler is the magazine's dining editor. Jeff Ruby is a dining critic. John Kessler is a food writer who are all joining us now. Hey, guys, welcome to the 21st.
Hi.
Hey. Hello.
Good morning. And so, of course, we know when it comes to food, you, our listeners, have plenty of opinions. Sarah told us on Facebook, for road trips close to home, which for her is in central Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, nothing beats hiking at Allerton, followed by lunch and pies at Inge at the Brown Bag in Monticello. The triple berry pie is the best. What do you think? Where do you like to road trip for great food? You can join in by calling 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Carrie, so you're the dining editor, and we would be remiss if we did not point out that this is James Beard Award Week in Chicago too, right? And I'm sure you eat pretty well all year round being in Chicago. What are you looking for though when you go on a road trip when it comes to food?
Well, when I go on a road trip, the number one thing that I'm looking for is that I'm getting food that really, you know, I can't get anywhere else. It's really going to give me a good memory of the place that I'm going. It's going to feel distinctive and special, and I'm going to enjoy looking back on the meal and think often about wanting to eat it again.
So, John, you traveled to Eastern Michigan, and I have to tell you, you have picked one of my favorite food destinations in the Midwest. I was in Ann Arbor last month and made a side trip to Dearborn specifically to eat.
It is so cool, isn't it?
It's the best. Tell us where you went, though.
So what I did is there's so much to choose from. And, you know, I'd been to Detroit several times. I love Detroit. I'd always wanted to go to Dearborn. So I decided to focus on West Warren Avenue area, which is kind of the, I think, probably the richest area to explore, although there's so many. And for me, the meal that I'll never forget is at Dearborn Meat Market, which is just looks like a little meat market in front, but has this back dining room where they grill kebabs that are $2.50 a piece and serve them to you just right off the grill, right in front of you, with you know, all sorts of grilled vegetables and pitas and just a zillion kinds of sauce to put on it. And it was just pretty magical.
So, Carrie, to your point about getting food somewhere, the food you can't get anywhere else, when we think about Eastern Michigan, there really is a Midwestern epicenter for Middle Eastern food, right, Carrie?
Yeah, definitely. There is just such a large Middle Eastern community, particularly centered around the Detroit area, but also throughout the region. And so there's really a lot to explore in the region.
Mm-hmm. John, how did this become such an epicenter of Middle Eastern food when we're thinking about not just Dearborn now, but it's kind of spread to there's a couple of different, you know, there's Dearborn Heights, there's a couple different towns around that area.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, my research, you know, what I learned from, you know, excellent research and resources like Wikipedia and other places, but the first big immigration of people from the Middle East were Lebanese who came to work in the auto industry at the turn of the century. And later on, I'm sorry, not the turn of the century, but a few.
Term of the previous century,
later.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly. And they, you know, established a large Lebanese-American community. But then in the past 20 years or so, they've been joined by a lot of people from Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. And, you know, for many different reasons, you know, mostly not good ones, you know, things happening in their homelands that they had to escape. And so there's some very poignant stories. You know, you meet, there's one man I met who runs a restaurant. He's from Aleppo, which is a very famous culinary destination throughout the Middle East. But we think now of just the ongoing, you know, never-ending war there and how badly that city suffered. So, but the food is just terrific. It is fresh and interesting and filled with, you know, he serves dishes you just won't find anywhere else.
I love Shatila, the bakery in Dearborn that has, it's sort of like walking into baklava heaven, and then there's all these other things that happen there too. Okay, so we're talking to John Kessler about Easter. Yeah, did you love it as well, John?
Oh my God, and the four kinds of canafe. I'm like such a canafe head after this trip. It's that, you know, it's that pastry with sort of melted cheese and rose water and shredded phyllo on top of it. And I just sort of think about it once every day now. So.
Okay. That's John Kessler. If you have places around the Midwest that you want to recommend that are in driving distance from Illinois, which you think are food destinations we should not miss, you can join the conversation at 1-800-222-9455. Food critic Jeff Ruby is also with us. Jeff, we've talked to Carrie and to John about what kind of their parameters are, but what are your food rules when you're on a road trip? What are you looking for?
Well, I like to pick places that I can show off to my friends that I went to, basically.
That you can Instagram?
Go there too. Yeah. Of course, my photography is lousy, but, you know, I'm a typical Chicagoan in that I see the state of Wisconsin as one gigantic playground, you know, filled with just fun stuff. And then you go to places like La Crosse, and it's kind of true. It just is, everything about it was just, I described it as like a mini Madison with more beer and less politics. And it really is an awesome place. And it's not large. It's like 50,000 people, but it feels metropolitan when you get into the restaurants and bars and stuff.
So you went to La Crosse. Why did you pick La Crosse, Jeff?
It has a sort of burgeoning scene that is kind of surprising for a town of that size. there's a downtown area that has been had some booms and busts over the years, but is like looking really good right now. And just concentrated bars. I was there in the middle of a blizzard, and yet it was just every place was packed. It was incredible.
And so when you're thinking about bars, are these kind of like typical Wisconsin, like supper clubs? I'm thinking about beer, cheese curds. What are we thinking about here?
There is some of that, but La Crosse has definitely more of a cosmopolitan vibe too. I mean, there's like, you know, there's plenty of supper house action there, and that's great. But there's also new places like La Crosse Distilling Company, which is like a geothermal powered distillery, and it has a tasting room and it sources all its ingredients from right around the area. I mean, it's, you know, as modern as can be. And then I went to a bar called the Casino Bar, which is this total throwback, you know, like art moderne details. They serve white Russians, and I don't know, just like everything about it was, it felt like you were transported back in time.
And what was the meal you had there that you are still thinking about, to John's point about the food he's still thinking about from Eastern Michigan?
I went to a cool place called Love Child, which is, I guess you'd call it Mediterranean. It's in this 19th century building that apparently used to be Hooters, which maybe the fact that now it's this, you know, gorgeous backlit mirror kind of Mediterranean place that is beloved by everyone, and it used to be a Hooters, maybe that tells you everything about kind of the direction that this town is going. It was really nice. It was really lovely. I had a caramelized onion crostini topped with maitake mushroom and taleggio sauce, and it was, you know, sitting at this long bar, and when somebody told me it used to be a Hooters there, I just kind of started laughing. It was impossible to imagine.
Okay, so Jeff Ruby went to La Crosse, Wisconsin. John Kessler went to Dearborn, Michigan. We want to hear from you. You can join the conversation at 1-800-222-9455. Tell us your favorite food destinations that are within driving distance of Illinois. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. Kathy actually just emailed us and said she's not in driving distance. She's going to England, and she's hoping to have lots of good fish and chips somewhere along the way for that summer vacation. Carrie, you hit up Cincinnati. You're from Columbus. So I wonder what made you want to head to the rival, this other rival Ohio town.
Well, even though I'm not a Cincinnatian, as an Ohioan, I do kind of feel like chili is a little bit of our birthright, you know. It's nobody who grew up outside of Ohio understands it, but if you...
So can you explain to all of the Illinoisans listening about Cincinnati chili? Because I've had it, but I think you should explain it because you're from Ohio.
So essentially, it's a very thin ground meat sauce. It's kind of heavily spiced with like cinnamon and cumin. Some people put cocoa in the mix. It's kind of almost like a little bit of Greek flavoring, and in fact, the original people who came up with the dish were Greek and Macedonian immigrants, and so they were using the readily available ground beef to make this meat sauce, and it's covered with probably like a month's worth of cheese, like your cheese allotment, and often eaten on
what kind of cheese?
Cheddar. Always cheddar, always very finely shredded, and it's either on pasta or on a hot dog. And if it's kind of a knife and fork situation if you're eating it on pasta.
Right. But is it also a knife and fork? It can't be a knife and fork situation if it's on a hot dog, is it, Carrie?
No, but it's definitely an eat it as fast as you possibly can situation. It's very precariously built.
And so when we're thinking about Cincinnati, the other thing that came to my mind was Grater's ice cream. I feel like that's nothing, something you should not miss if you're in Cincinnati. Right, Carrie?
Absolutely not. We also had some Grater's locations in Columbus growing up, and so I've been spreading the gospel of Grater's my entire life. But I really it's some of the best ice cream out there.
Graters is excellent. Yeah, it is amazing ice cream, and it's sold in grocery stores all across Illinois, but it is made in Cincinnati. We are hearing, this is great. We're hearing from every social media platform. Sharon on Instagram says, West Union, Illinois for fried catfish dinners. Apparently, we've heard from a caller that there is a famous burger place in Mattoon, Illinois that's called Burger King, but it's not the chain. And Kevin on Facebook has a question for us. So if you, call back if we lost that call, 1-800-222-9455. Kevin on Facebook asks, when I travel, I get food anxiety. How do I pick the right place to eat? Or do you have any tips from your guests on how to make sure you hit the, quote, must-have places on a trip? Jeff, what do you think?
You got you got to research before you go. You show up and you're like, oh, this looks good. You're always going to be let down, or else you're going to find that, you know, it's too crowded to get in.
So how do you do research if it's a small place? Because are you like, I think like, do I find like there's not every city has like a, you know, only big cities have like eaters or like are you on Yelp? Like, are you finding these places?
I mean, you know, call me a simpleton. I Google best restaurants La Crosse and read as much as I can and see what keeps popping up. And if a place sounds really good, then maybe I'll go to the website, check it out. And, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's rocket science for me. But then again, maybe I'm not as picky. I like to just go to a town and just eat whatever, like Carrie was saying, you eat what people eat there and get a feel for the town.
Carrie, do you have Carrie, do you have advice? What I did when I was in Ann Arbor was I actually asked my Lyft driver, who happened to be Jordanian. I didn't realize what a big Jordanian population there was. And then we ended up having a 20-minute conversation about food. And then I left that Lyft with four places to eat. Carrie, what other advice do you have for people who are maybe driving somewhere? How to do research ahead of time?
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of the Lyft, Uber, taxi driver interrogation. I also often will ask a bartender because I feel like bartenders, as opposed to someone maybe at a hotel who is going to just give you kind of the touristy things, bartenders, after you've been there for a little while, you can have a really
ask after the second drink.
They know the good places.
We've got Ian on the line from Springfield. Let's go to a caller. Hi, Ian. Welcome to the 21st. I understand you have a recommendation in St. Louis.
Yeah, my wife and I originally lived closer to the city, but now that even we're an hour and a half away in Taylor Springs, we love to go every now and then to Lulu's Seafood Restaurant on the north side, and by far the best Chinese within driving distance, if an hour and a half's driving distance.
So Lulu's Chinese, you said Lulu's Seafood and it's Chinese?
Yeah. It's a Chinese restaurant. On Saturdays, they do this dim sum thing where they bring around the cart and you get to pick stuff off the plate and buy it a la carte.
It is
to die for. And it's, you know, if you're a person who likes romaine, like simple things too, like their romaine's hands down incredible, doesn't leave a syrupy, oily feel in your mouth. It feels like real romaine.
Okay. Well, thanks, Ian. That's a good one. Carrie, I wonder, I know you were having a Twitter conversation with some of our producers yesterday about chain restaurants versus mom and pop places. Do you think we're always better off going with a local place?
You know, I am a big proponent of eating what feels good to you in the moment. And sometimes it is a chain restaurant, but
sometimes it's a Frosty.
Exactly. And sometimes you're in the mood to do some exploration, and in that case, definitely look outside of the Olive Gardens, but there's nothing wrong with it every once in a while.
Okay. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately, but I want to let everyone know that we've tweeted out the link to all of the places that Chicago Magazine has talked about. Hey, John, before we go, quick question for you. Any final advice for folks when they're traveling on the road this summer? Food-wise?
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is, one, you know, a road trip is the time to have your once-a-decade bloomin' onion, and if you want that, just eat the thing, and then, you know, enjoy the chain restaurants, but also, I do think Yelp is great. I used to take my kids a lot to the Gulf Shore Beach from our home in Atlanta. And when I realized I was going by a Kia plant, I thought, oh my God, there must be a million Korean restaurants around here. And sure enough, Yelp led us to a great Korean restaurant.
Oh, there you go.
So, yeah, there's
okay.
my advice.
I want to thank John Kessler, Jeff Ruby, Carrie Shedler for being with us. And we'll tweet out that link to all the reporting Chicago Magazine has done on this. Thanks, you guys. And thanks, everyone who called, emailed, tweeted, posted on social media.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. That, of course, is the theme to Jeopardy. And if you are a fan of the game show, you know it is a very exciting time in that world. James Holzhauer, a Naperville native and U of I grad who now lives in Las Vegas, has won almost $1.7 million as a contestant on the show, and he's still competing. Jeopardy stands out in the world of game shows. It first started airing in 1964 and is still going strong, even as TV has changed. But what's it really like to be part of this? Whether you're a contestant hoping to win big or someone behind the scenes trying to make this fun and engaging for the millions of people watching. Jasmine Leonis lives in Chicago and was on a contestant on Jeopardy last Monday, actually. We're also joined by Adam Nadiff. He's a game show historian and author whose latest book is Game Shows Frequently Asked Questions, FAQ. Jasmine, Adam, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Nyla.
Good to be here.
Jasmine, so you were on one of the same shows as James.
Yeah.
And I should say in full disclosure to our audience, we used to work together. So I have been following your Jeopardy journey on Facebook well before it actually aired. But I wanted to just first ask you about your experience. I have to say, I feel like when you were a journalist, you have a lot of friends who end up on Jeopardy because a lot of journalists seem to end up on Jeopardy. But how did you go about doing this? How do you even get considered to make it onto the show?
Oh, it's a very long process. I'm like most people who have been on the show, I wanted to go on for years. So I tried out first in college, which was a while ago. But they now do an online test. So I've taken the online test multiple times. I did well enough to get called for an audition in 2017. You go through an audition and then you wait for a call. Then it was another 2 years to get a call, and then I finally got on the show. We taped in February and aired this past Monday.
Wow, so you auditioned 2 years ago.
Yes.
And then you just kind of, do they tell you we're going to call you, or you just don't know?
You don't know. I mean, they basically say you're in the contestant pool for, I think it's 18 months roughly, and just wait for our call. If you don't get a call, try out again. It's a long process, and you just cross your fingers and hope that you'll get through.
So what happens in the audition? The online test makes sense, right? They're probably just asking you different trivia, but what do they do when you actually go for the audition?
Well, you take another test there. It's a written test this time. You have a few seconds to answer each question, just trying to make sure that you did well in the online test and that translates to doing well on the show. You play a mock game where you actually have a buzzer and a game board and everything. You get interviewed by some of the producers to, that part where you give your little stories. You're kind of basically showing them that you can do that on television. You basically show them that you are enthusiastic and you love trivia and you'd be great for the show.
Adam, is this pretty standard that this kind of long process Jasmine's describing, that she is waited 2 years to get a call back? Is this just how Jeopardy works?
I think it's how Jeopardy works. You do have to take an audition and take a sample test on pretty much all game shows. It's just to make sure that they have contestants who, of course, know what they're doing and who make for interesting television. But I think it's just owing to the sheer popularity of Jeopardy that they have such a long wait for the screening process.
And so given this whole buildup, Jasmine, what was it like when you finally got to step onto the show?
Well, I feel like I had a special situation because of the champion that's on right now.
Yes.
So
other Illinoisan, we won't talk about him for a minute.
Okay, good. No, you have about a month to prepare from when they actually call you to when you actually tape in Los Angeles. So during that month, I was you know, watching the show, I was reading up on strategy and like how to time the buzzer. I would stand with a toilet paper holder, actually, which is kind of around the same size and feel as the buzzer. So I feel like I prepared as well as I could. And then you get there and you never know what your categories are going to be, who you're playing. So in my situation, I was playing against possibly one of the best players ever. So there's no real way to fully prepare for it. It's an out-of-body experience.
And so what's the time like? This was taped a couple months ago, right?
Yep. It was taped in February, late February.
And so that's the time frame. And so the shows... So Adam, how is it working with James now, who's on this winning streak? He could have already lost and we don't know, right?
It's completely possible. Even though I have friends in the business, I genuinely don't know how long this is going to go or if he's lost already. What I'm curious about is when Jasmine came to the studio, did they let the contestants know you're going up against a contestant who's kind of a steamroller right now? Did you, obviously the shows hadn't started airing yet, but did they clue you in about the kind of opponent you were about to face?
They did. So we.
Oh, they did? What did they say, Jasmine?
Yeah. So we gathered in the green room and we kind of, you know, filled out our paperwork, started doing our makeup, but kind of like getting ready to be on the show. And there was another contestant there who wasn't really talking to many other people. And the producer came in and said, "This is James. He has won. How many games have you won?" He had won 17 at that point.
Oh, no.
There was a lot of kind of like gasps in the room. How much money have you won, James? And then she told us he'd won more than $1 million. He'd broken records already. You know, they weren't super specific on, you know, every game that he had won, but they gave us enough of information to know that, like, this guy was going to be pretty tough to beat. But there's not, you know, it's a very quick process. You get there in the morning and you're doing practice rounds and you're getting your makeup and everything done. So it was really fast. And I was on the Monday game, so I taped first. So it was even faster for me. I didn't get to watch anybody else play before I got on that stage. So you get a little bit of information, but you don't really know how fast he is on the buzzer until you actually are playing him.
And then he's super fast, right, Jasmine? I mean, that's kind of, is that in... Well, Jasmine, I want you to answer that before I ask Adam a question.
Okay, yeah. So the buzzer in Jeopardy, if you ring in too fast, you're actually locked out for, like, I think half a second. And then if you ring in too slow, obviously someone's going to beat you. So it's really a matter of timing rather than speed. And he's just got the timing down. And the more he plays, the better he gets at it. So it kind of just keeps rolling along. As you keep playing, you get better at that buzzer. And he's just mastered it.
So there's that kind of strategy, but Jasmine, there's also the knowledge part of this. What kind of things do you feel like you prepped on that you didn't know? I feel like journalists and foreign journalists, we are at a somewhat of an advantage here because we know a lot about a little about a lot of things. But what did you feel like you really didn't know about that you had to learn?
One of the big things that I kept seeing coming up in different shows was opera. And I have, you know, not a deep knowledge of opera. But I tried to learn at least a surface amount so that I could answer the more standard questions, the more popular operas. I tried to get that down. Of course, I wasn't asked about opera at all in my show, so that was a waste of time. I tried to really focus more on, like, wagering strategy and that kind of thing, because that was going to happen no matter what. Category-wise, opera was the only real one that I was like, I have to prep for this. I don't know enough about it to feel comfortable. And I did going in, but didn't really help me in the end.
So that's Jasmine Leonis. We've been talking to. She lives in the Chicago area. She was on Jeopardy most recently. Again, since we've been talking about the new Jeopardy champion, I don't know what other term we want to use for James Holzhauer, who's actually also from Illinois. He's a Naperville native. He went to the University of Illinois. He lives in Las Vegas. And Adam, for people who have not watched him, my mother happens to be particularly fascinated with this, so I'm getting lots of updates about how this whole thing is going on. And Jasmine, I told you already, my mom was super impressed that I knew you. But
Mother, thank you.
Adam, how much of the... I feel like James has kind of shaken the Jeopardy game up a little bit in his style and the way that he not just wagers, but plays the game.
Yeah, he's kind of broken the game. He's not the first person to do this, but because he's so successful with getting a lot of attention, most people who have seen Jeopardy over the years see the way that the contestants pick the categories, which is they pick one category, they start at the lowest value clue, and then they work their way down. what James is doing is, instead of working the board vertically, he's working the board horizontally, and he's starting at the bottom. So he clears out all the $1,000 clues, then all the $800 clues, then all the $600 clues. So he has this enormous bankroll of money to work with by the time he gets to a daily double.
And then he's very aggressive with his betting with the daily doubles.
Yeah, and I think the sports betting background plays into it. One of the things people have noticed is that for a guy who's making the huge risks that he has, he seems very, very calm and very relaxed about it. And I think that comes from the way he's made a living up to this point. And I think, honestly, as he wins more money, it's just going to keep happening. There's no real incentive for him to stop now because he's won about $1.5 million. Once you've won that much money, you know, you don't need to be conservative. You've already won a ton of money. It's yours. So I think when he returns here in a week and a half to keep playing the game after the teachers tournament, it's just going to keep going. I really think, and again, I don't know anything at this point, but my suspicion is the only way he can really lose at this point is to have some really, really bad luck when he finds daily doubles.
How does this work with Jeopardy? On the one hand, I feel like this is giving the show a lot of extra attention that it hasn't gotten in a while. But on the other, he's also making a lot of money. Is there a limit to how much money you can make on Jeopardy, Adam?
There is not a limit to how much money you can make on Jeopardy. The rules have changed over the years. In the very, very beginning in 1984, the limit was $75,000, which is kind of funny to think about now. There is no limit. James is just going to keep going. I'm sure that he's, as a friend of mine, Bob Bowden, has put it in a few interviews he's given about this, he is almost certainly causing headaches for Sony's accountants, because it's fine to have a long winner on Jeopardy. There's no question that Sony and that Jeopardy are very, very happy with how this is going. But at the same time, when you have a guy who is winning $130,000 a night on a game show where people generally win about $20,000 to $30,000 in a game, that's got to be blindsiding them somehow. So I'm sure Sony has the money between the couch cushions somewhere if they scrape hard enough. But, yeah, this is definitely coming as a surprise to them, and I'm sure they're trying to figure out where they can scrape up some of that money if they need to.
Adam, I was wondering, though, how much money extra money they're making because of maybe if more people are watching, and maybe obviously not the difference, but I just think the amount of tension and how many people. I mean, I haven't watched Jeopardy, I'll be honest, for years, and it was kind of one of those things. I grew up watching it. We watched it every night when I was a kid, but I haven't watched it in a while, and I've started watching now, and I bet there are probably a lot of people like that, right?
There are probably a lot of people, and the great thing for Jeopardy is James happened to come along right as they were approaching the month of May, and the May in television is one of the sweeps months, which is when television sets the advertising rates for TV shows. So Jeopardy happens to be getting this huge publicity boost right as they're about to set the new advertising rates. So I'm sure some extra money is about to come in because of James, which is great news for them just from that level. And as you said, you want people to pay attention to the show, and that's the great thing about Jeopardy that not a lot of shows have these days. Jeopardy is one of the few remaining shows that has returning champions, and they get this boost of publicity every time they have a champion that goes on a run longer than 6 or 7 games, and more game shows should take advantage of that.
Yeah, it's
right
a pretty
now,
good formula,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's Adam Nadif, game show historian and author. Jasmine Leonis has also been with us. Jasmine, so has your Jeopardy experience, I wonder if this has made you want to go on other shows or what you've taken away from this?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, Jeopardy, you kind of get one shot at it, and my shot is over, and I've been dreaming about it for so long that it's made me think, well, maybe I can test my trivia knowledge somewhere else. So I looked into possibly going on some other shows in the future just because you get started and you want to keep going. So hopefully I get another shot because you don't really walk away with that much as a second or third place.
But you have walked away with a lot of attention that you probably thought you weren't going to get, right, Jasmine? In a good way.
Mostly in a good way. I've had a lot of really positive responses. Some, you know, on the internet, there's some not very nice people, but mostly people have been very positive. So that's been a nice thing. People I haven't talked to in a while happen to catch me on the show. So that's been a positive.
That's Jasmine Leonis, a Chicago area Jeopardy contestant. And I want to thank Adam Native for being with us as well, a game show historian and author. His latest book is called Game Shows FAQ. Adam, Jasmine, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for having us.
That does it for us today and for this week. On Monday, we're going to be talking about what it's like to try and get mental health treatment if you are a refugee. Follow us on Twitter. Search for our handle. It's 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis, background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you search for the 21st to like us, it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, is all at our website. That's 21stshow.org. That's also where we archive our past shows. But if you can also find us places you get podcasts, we're on Spotify, iTunes, NPR One. Search for the 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.